Hello, and welcome to Open Door, a podcast that gives you a glimpse into the classrooms of amazing teachers from all around the world. I'm Chris Galley, and I'm joined today, as always, by my co-host, colleague, and friend, Mr. Lee Blowers. The name of the show, Open Door, came from the idea of opening your classroom door and being open to collaboration and sharing your teaching practice. Today, Lee and I had the opportunity to open the doors of our school and welcome in a truly inspirational educator. We're delighted to be joined in person for this very special episode by Jacob Hansen. Jacob is an educational rebel and troublemaker. He's passionate about challenge-based learning, social constructivism, and the role of technology in learning. He's currently taken on a new role as a freelance advisor and has worked with schools across Europe to help unfold creative ideas related to curriculum and design. Jacob is currently embarking on a British tour with his son, taking in visits to schools across the country. Jacob has also recently started his own podcast, Breakfast Conversations, where he sits down for conversations over a coffee or tea, all about education. I'm a big fan of his show, and it was a huge pleasure to create this crossover episode with Jacob, mixing the Open Door and Breakfast Conversations formats. The topic we chose for the show was disrupting education, and the three of us discuss what we value in education and how we'd like to see education develop in the future. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did. Let's get into it.
Welcome to this co-production between Open Door and Breakfast Conversations. Today we are going to produce our podcast together. I have the lucky opportunity to be here in London and have invited myself to see your school. And together with me today is Chris Galley and Lee Blowers from Open Door Podcast. Hi. And so glad to have got a tour on your school today.
Well, good. You're very welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. And in the spirit of our podcast, it was really nice to open the doors to our schools, to our classrooms, and to sit down in person and to finally have this conversation.
Yeah, I thought with that title, I could just try to invite myself, test it out. So now we are sitting together, so I can see that you are coffee drinkers.
Very much so.
Yeah. Are there any sort of typical British breakfast traditions then, or would you?
Well, I heard on your last episode you're talking about the fry-up, traditional English breakfast. Are you a fan, Lee?
I am a fan. I'll confess, though, I am a vegetarian, so the typical British fry-up, including black pudding, bacon, sausage, is out for me. I'm all about mushrooms and tomatoes, really. Very nice. How about yourself?
You know, I'm not a fan of traditional breakfast. I don't really like a lot of the ingredients in there, so I tend to stick with a sausage butty, a bacon butty. Yeah, that would be it for me. What about you, Jacob?
I like to travel, and when I'm traveling, I try to eat from the local cuisine. Mm-hmm. And normally in our weekends, I really liked having the time to sit together with my kids and my wife, and then breakfast is quite important. Mm-hmm. But I think actually more it's the family time that is important. But then there will be a couple of eggs, and my kids, they prefer them scrambled, and I would like a softly boiled egg and so on. So then we make what everyone likes. and then breakfast can take hours sometimes. Yep. On the weekends.
Individualized breakfasts. Just as I enjoy my education.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the way it should be. And I know you are both working at, this is an international school, but also that you have worked in other countries.
Mm-hmm, that's right, yeah.
How has that influenced your are some of the local cuisines that you have taken with you?
Also, I've got a rice cooker at home.
Yeah.
So I was in Japan for 5 years and I couldn't rice cooker. I also, there's a Japanese store not far from the school, and they sell natto, which is kind of an old fermented bean, kind of moldy beans, and they stink. I absolutely adore them. So I have those at least 4 or 5 times a week.
Smelly beans.
Smelly beans.
So I was in Mexico for 5 years, and my wife is also Mexican, and so we have a cupboard at home just full of spicy sauces. So we have a lot of spicy sauce with everything. Yeah. And every time we go there, or every time someone visits, we stock up.
Mm. And did you also eat tacos as breakfast in Mexico? I was quite surprised that a lot of people are eating.
Yeah, funny enough, there's a really good documentary on Netflix all about tacos, if you're a fan. And so there are different types that you would have at different points in a day. Yeah. So there's barbacoa, which is a traditional breakfast taco.
Wow.
And it's a whole episode just on how they make barbacoa. A good like half an hour. Really interesting.
Sounds good.
A tip. And I got confused a couple of days ago. I was in the northern part of England and visiting Paul Tullock, and they were asking us if we wanted to have tea in the evening.
Oh, yeah.
And Adam said, oh, I don't like tea. Can I get something else to drink?
I'll have coffee.
Yeah. And then we just discovered that it was actually there.
Yeah, this north-south divide.
Yeah.
With nomenclature.
So.
How would you refer to the meal that you eat in the evening?
I go breakfast, lunch, dinner.
See, I'm from the north of England as well, so I would very often refer to that evening meal as tea.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So that
causes a lot of confusion.
Yeah. We learned something new this week, so that's always nice. I would really love to hear a bit about the background story for you starting to podcast. I think the podcast journey is quite new for both of us, but I have really enjoyed following your podcast. So now I'm sitting together with you. I'd love to hear
a story behind it. We started earlier this year, and in fact, the conversations prior to that started probably a year before that. It was about this time last year we started sharing a lunchtime duty together. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, during those conversations, we started talking, I really fancy starting a podcast. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that'd be a great idea. And this went on for about 6 months, and then eventually got to the point where one of us, I think it was Lee, said, this is something I want to do. And so we sat down in a coffee shop over a coffee and just planned it out. And, you know, I think we both love the medium of podcasts. We both love listening to educational podcasts. And so getting the opportunity to talk to all of these inspirational educators from around the world, just like you're doing, it's great PD, I think, for ourselves. And to be able to share that with people is amazing.
I think that was one of my first sort of motivations. So being in Japan, there was lots and lots of PD and opportunities.
Yeah.
And then I came back to the UK, and I found it quite difficult to find open PDs where you can just talk to other educators and get a chance to find out what they're doing in their classroom. Whether you agree or disagree with it, it's all very, very positive. So I was just really desperate to work with Chris as well, who is a very inspirational teacher, and to get chatting to as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. How about for yourself? So Breakfast Conversations is fairly new. How and why did it start?
I think a bit similar reasons. It's something that I mainly do for myself. Mm-hmm. having that opportunity to ask people to chat with me for an hour. And sometimes if I just wanted to call people randomly and say, would you like to chat with me for an hour? It could maybe be a bit creepy, but having a podcast and people say, oh yeah, you would love to. I have also thought about it for years. And suddenly I took the decision, and I surprised myself a bit about it, because I had thought English isn't my language, my third language. So it was, but I really find that having the Apple Distinguished Educator community, but also just in general as teachers, I think it's so important that we feel connected, and having this coming from a small country, I find it really valuable to both have this community with teachers from all over the world, but also seeing how different we are doing things, that we are, there's a lot of things that we have in common and can share and can find some comfort in, that we have the same struggles and same, but also that we are doing things differently. I think that is also inspires the way that I think about education and get new ideas. So So I think that international connections were important. So I just knew that even though I have good English skills, I need to make it in English because I wanted that international dimension in it.
Yeah, and it's about being a risk taker as well, isn't it? As we hadn't done this before. It's a very new venture, and you're learning so many skills, just like, you know, when students podcast in the classroom, you know, the collaboration, the planning, all of the work that goes on behind the scenes, never mind the conversation. It's a really valuable experience, and I think we've got a lot out of it ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel very comfortable sitting here chatting with you now, but if we go back to our first episode, I think we paused and recorded and paused and recorded, and you can still hear in our voices how nervous we were, sort of public speaking. And it's been an incredible journey of learning and discovering more about ourselves.
Yeah, definitely think that's an interesting part of it. And you have had some really great guests on your show as well. I think that's really...
You know, very often I look back at our feed and I think, oh, that was my favorite episode. But and then I find myself switching.
Yeah, definitely. It's been jumping sort of forward and back. And I think for us, our podcast is as good as the guests we have. It's all about discovering people with interesting ideas or opinions. Again, we don't have to particularly agree with them all, but it's good to have people who are just willing to talk and share their passions.
I think now we are sitting in your classroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is my room.
Yeah. So can you tell a bit about your school, where we are today, and
yeah, so we are an international baccalaureate school. We go from early childhood, so that's sort of 3 years old, all the way up to grade 5, which for us in the UK system is year 6. So that's
10 and 11
years old. That's right. Yeah. So we follow the PYP program. We are 2 classes per year group.
Mm-hmm. So we have about 220 students across the school. Being an international school, there's children from all around the world, about 40 different countries, about 30 different languages spoken in the school. So lots of diversity, and certainly enriches the culture, makes those classroom conversations really interesting, really diverse.
Yeah.
And it's located here in the northern part of London?
In Hampstead.
Hampstead.
So it's a really nice area. We're quite close to Hampstead Heath, so that's a space that we can go and use if we need to. But just being in London, one of the school's philosophies is having no walls for our learning, so getting out into our communities and learning as much as we can. So we're in a very, very good location for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, using London as a classroom really enriches the topics that we're looking at.
Yeah, well, it must really be, I do. I think a couple of weeks ago, our other teacher asked me on Twitter a bit about podcasting in English and not being my native language. Mm-hmm. I thought, yeah, but Denmark, it's a small country, 5.5 million people, so it's fewer people than are living in London. I just need that global outreach, and I think it must be wonderful to have a city like London with all the museums, many of them free, and all the multicultural aspects of it, and huge diversity.
We're really fortunate. In grade 4, we're just starting a religions unit. And so within the classroom, we've got children who follow lots of different belief systems. But even if we don't have families within the class, we can still go out and we can go to a synagogue, we can go to a mosque, we can go to a Hindu temple, and they can see these things happening in real life. And so it really brings the learning to life. And that's the same, I think, for any topic across the school.
Yeah, I think so. We're doing units at the moment about materials and design. And there is the Design Museum in London, which is a beautiful place to go visit. There are materials museums. There are just so many places to go. And actually, the more you reach out to these people, you realize they're willing to come in and they want to share their expertise. Mm-hmm. So it's very much an open school. Of people sort of coming in and out and sharing expertise. And if you can, use the community as best as you can. It's great.
Yeah, and I think the Design Museum has got a new location a couple of years ago here in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't visited it since I've gone to a new location.
It's a beautiful building.
Yeah, it's worth going to. I recommend it. I love it there.
Yeah, me too.
I always think my stays here in London, they are way too short. And when we're flying out of it and seeing, looking down on London, I think, okay, that I need to see next time. Yeah. Must be fantastic to have those possibilities.
Yeah. So let us ask you a question.
Yeah.
You've been traveling in England for nearly a week now. Tell us a bit about your travels. What's the purpose of your trip?
This time it was really, I wanted to mix in a bit of work with a lot of pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also having worked really a lot actually, since I got my kids and also when they were smaller, I thought I really also enjoy to have the opportunity to travel together with my kids. And this time I have brought my oldest son, mm-hmm. Adam, with me. So we have time to explore, but also just to visit some couple of schools. And he has actually holiday this week, but then still drag him into school. Yeah, but I think it has a lot of learning in seeing different cultures, and our part of Denmark isn't that, don't have the same kind of diversity that you have in London, mm-hmm. as well, and just seeing, I think, and experience different cultures. And I think Denmark and England is, of course, close to each other. It takes only less than 2 hours to come over here.
Yeah.
But still, there's so many things that are very different in how we approach education in those countries.
Definitely.
So I really have loved to come to England just because there's so much inspiration in doing it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And for yourself, what is the purpose of actually visiting the schools, maybe sort of in terms of your career, in terms of your job, to give our listeners an idea of who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I've been working quite a lot for the last 10 years, where I've been also in the classroom, further education. So my students, they had been from 16, but normally from 18 years, and then up till mid-20, end 20. But I think now I have taken a bit of time where I first took a sabbatical, and now I have gone more full-time in and taken the decision to try to build up a career as a more independent consultant, trying to help schools in new ways. And I'm still exploring how that could be, finding a way into that. But I really love just having, I feel that I can reflect more freely, explore new ideas in a different way than I had could before. So I have been very, very happy to and totally satisfied with the opportunities that I had at the school where I have worked, and have worked with really great people. But now having that combination out and trying to be totally on my own and having to earn my own money and do something valuable, but also just, and I think suddenly I realized that I was quite well paid as a teacher. but yeah, I think it inspires me in a totally different way to travel now. And so that's my main, right now I try to explore some new ideas about education. I really think that we need to rethink education in general. I think a lot of the things that we are doing in education are much more based on traditions and we things that we used to do, and it has grown organically.
Mm-hmm.
And very few things that we are doing in education is actually informed by future predictions, what kind of societies will our kids actually work in when we look, mm-hmm. 10, 15, 20 years ahead. And if you look 20 years ahead, I think schools, they should be valuable in that time frame. Everything that we are doing today should, when they look back in 20 years' time, say, okay, that was the skills I developed in school are actually useful right now. And I think there are so many things going to change over the next 20, 30 years, and that is things that I try to look into right now and try to reflect on how we can help schools create that kind of change and make them more aware of, if you should start with a blank canvas and really much more think about what we expect the future to be like, how would we then actually design schools and education that would be helpful in that context.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's very worrying sometimes, isn't it, when you go into a school and the way in which it's set up, the way in which the teachers teach, the students learn is very similar to what would have happened 100 years ago in a classroom. There's not a lot that's altered.
Now, and I must say, when I look at my kids' classrooms, they are so similar to the classrooms I were in as a school kid.
Yeah,
I was thinking about this earlier, and I was thinking this is really kind of the right time, I think, for all educators worldwide to pause and to reflect on what is the purpose of education. I saw that in England, the last time that as a conversation actually came up was in 76. So the Prime Minister was James Callaghan. It was known as the Great Debate, where people actually talked about why should children be going to school? And when they go to school, what are we hoping for them to actually get? And since then, there's been huge scientific, technological progress, looking at things like globalization, the state of world politics, climate change, poverty. You know, this is not the same world as the one in which national education was created, yet the classrooms are still those same classrooms. So that conversation needs to be had of why are we educating children in this way?
Yeah, and I think when you look at how much time we spend in education and in school, it's a huge percentage of our lives, so we really need to make it valuable for the kids and relevant and fun. So that they
yeah, absolutely. I think one small example that really stuck out to me recently was there was a bit of a conversation about the time that middle schoolers should be starting. So there was a lot of research that actually school was beginning way too early.
Yeah, in the morning.
Yeah, early in the morning, and children just weren't at their best at that time. And maybe we should start school a little bit later, and they work until later in the afternoon before they go home. And I think the only reason that that didn't change was for parents, because of their work times. And that to me sounds crazy. We're putting the parents' convenience before the students' learning.
But I actually, I think you're right, and I think we have a lot of research that actually shows that that would be much more healthy to start a bit later and that would get more out of it. But when in Denmark, most kids, they go to public schools, around 80% of them. And visiting countries where it's much more, parents, they take a choice on which school their kids should go to and which programs they should follow and so on. I think in Denmark, and for there's a lot of good things in it as well, that school, that the kids go to the same schools no matter their background and their parents' income and so on, and they all meet in the same school. But still, that I'm sometimes surprised that not more parents in Denmark are taking a deliberate choice on what kind of school and what kind of education they want for their kids, and having a bit bigger demands for the schools and say, okay, I really want to, I believe in challenge-based learning and so on, I believe in that approach, I would like my kid to work with the global sustainability goals because I think there would be a lot of jobs in that area or something like that. And I see, my feeling is at least that in the UK that at least the parents that can afford to, they would take a very deliberate choice of school.
That's funny. There's this culture in the UK of postcodes and the distance that you are to the school that you want your children to go to. And in some ways, it's created quite a strange, toxic culture around schools and the neighborhoods that you're going to choose to live in as a family. And that distance as the crow flies from your house to the school can determine the education that your child gets.
I think that helps create sort of a lot of the inequality that we see in the UK as well. So many of the sort of the schools that are seen to be doing very, very well are where people want to buy houses close to that. So you end up with just the people who can afford to send their children to the quote unquote better schools. sort of push towards that, and then you see the people who have less money, less income, shoved out away from those quote-unquote better schools.
Yeah, I think that's really a sad part of it, that we often, if a child get, if your schools fail one child, it will often take generations, will affect the children of that child as well, and where that child can go to school. And I think actually, ideally, it should be the opposite, that every generation get their own opportunities, no matter what kind of parents they have and parents' income and so on.
Well, yeah, and there's been a lot of talk in the past couple of weeks in the UK, particularly with the Labour Party here, and they've been proposing that they get rid of private schools and that, you know, schools should be equal for all children. It's raised a lot of controversy.
It really has. I think it's maybe moving more in line with that Danish system that you were saying, where all schools are kind of seen as the same and there's less choice, perhaps. Yeah, big positives, big negatives towards it.
Yeah, but I think also it's finding that right balance between choice, and I think also it's good if families have choice, but finding ways where actually all families can get some choice. But I also think that in Denmark, private schools are actually getting not exactly the same amount that a public school would cost, but the parents, we only have to pay a bit more than the difference between the public school and the private school. Mm-hmm. So you can also, you don't need to have a high income to choose to go to a private school, because you pay the difference. So the money will follow the kid. So creating a situation where also the public schools have to compete for the good kids as well, for every kid that they want to come in. Mm. I think actually that's quite interesting. That, and also I think for kids it's very healthy to have friends from every culture, every Definitely. Economic background. So if they end up in as a CEO in a big company afterwards, but they still have friends that are maybe struggling a bit more in life and so on, but they can relate to each other and know that they went to school together and have a shared history. I think that's very healthy for a society, that we don't grow up in those silos where we don't talk with families that are different from ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
I was quite impressed about how much project work you're doing in the school.
Yeah.
Some of the projects. Could you please dive into a bit of the mindset behind it and the work?
Yeah.
We're doing here.
Yeah, sure. So our approach to teaching and learning is based around inquiry. So we start out thinking about what the children know about a topic. So that will very often start with a pre-assessment, thinking about what previous knowledge do they have about a topic. So for example, in grade 4 right now, as I said, we're looking at religion. So we start out thinking about what do the children know about different religions and their backgrounds. And what do they want to know? What are they curious about learning? And so that will inform where we go as teachers. And for example, in a unit which we just finished about pollution, the children ended up specializing in different areas of pollution that they were interested in. And they connected this back to the sustainable development goals. And so we had one group that was inquiring into plastic pollution. We had another group that was inquiring into air pollution. And there was another group which was looking at renewable sources of energy. And so throughout the school, they're building up these research skills, these social skills, these communication skills. So as you were saying, they can apply these later on when they get to grade 5 and they have what's called the exhibition, which is a longer, much more student-led project which lasts about 8 weeks. But also applying that in real-life situations once they get onto middle school or eventually into employment.
Yeah.
And so I think as a culture, we try to model it as teachers in terms of the way in which we learn and our professional development model as well. Mm. And so it's definitely part of the school's culture.
Yeah, and I think that kind of projects I really like, because sometimes I get the question when I'm giving presentations that, yeah, but we can't predict the future, so it's maybe better not to change. I say, okay, we can. The world will definitely not be static. So just keeping on to do what we ever have done, that will definitely not be the right solution. But I think in general, it's of course right. We can't predict the future, but working with the sustainability goals and environmental issues, I think that's definitely one area where I think we could hope that we will solve those problems in our lifetime and in the kids' lifetime. But I think it's very unrealistic to think that we actually will solve those problems. So I think there will be a lot of jobs in working with those topics and especially also those skills that you develop. So I think, when I get the questions, what kind of things should we then work with? I think that is always a good starting point to work with the sustainability goals.
Yeah, and going back to what you were saying before about what is the purpose of education, I think I got asked this once in an interview that they asked, you know, why do you want to work here? Why do you want to be a teacher? And I think my response was, well, I want to try to craft a better world. You know, you want to create citizens of the world who are going to make a difference, who are going to be looking after us when we're older. And, you know, they're going to be guardians of the planet. And having something like the Sustainable Development Goals, it makes that tangible. It makes them aware of the issues that we have in the world, and they get to think about solutions towards those goals.
And I really agree with that, but I also think that it's not just those goals. They're not a static set of 17 goals that can never ever change. The point is about identifying goals, then knowing what to do with that information. How do I get more information? How do I connect with other people to learn more? It's almost that hive mind idea of, I might not be the person who knows the most, so how do I pull everyone else in and learn and communicate together, and then use the skills that I've learned to find new problems and new solutions? And I think that's what we need to be developing in students. We don't know the future. So how can we prepare them to learn what the new problems and solutions are going to be?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point, because and also having that focus on that they are learning those kind of skills, how to collaborate, how to distribute tasks in a group, how to use each other's resources. Because in a workplace later on, they don't need to be an expert in all. And I think both in Danish and the English system, we are measuring each individual kid. But as we know, in a workforce, we need to work as a team, and it's the accomplishments of the team that is important. It's not the individual accomplishments.
And I think there's very often there's a disconnect, isn't there, between what we want schools to be teaching children and then how schools actually assess students' learning. And, you know, we're still very much in that mindset of, well, you've got to sit an exam and that's going to define who you are and what you know about a subject. And so you've got this process of rote learning and focusing on dates and facts, when actually it's skills and your ability to work with people, which is going to be far more important and far more valuable for an employer in the future.
I think if you ask an employer, what would you like, a student who can remember and write down facts, or a student who can communicate and connect other people? I think you're always going to go for that second person.
Yeah, and I think especially the first person you describe is, you already see a lot of digital software-based robots taking that kind of jobs in companies right now. And I think also we shouldn't be afraid of the future in that way, but I think automation, industrial, this new industrial revolution, we are already seeing it unfolding right now. We often talk about the 21st century skills. Also, we talked a bit about it before the podcast, that we talk about it as something that's going to happen in the future, but we are 20% into the 21st century, and we see it unfold now, and we shouldn't wait as schools to work with those 21st century skills. We should already be in the middle of it.
Yeah, we should be on our way for sure.
Yeah, I think it was a couple of years ago I got to go to the Apple Education Leadership Summit here in London, and they were talking about, again, the power of these 21st century skills and how we should be developing children for this future, which we don't know what it would be like. They were talking about how a lot of those low-skill jobs, as you were saying, are being replaced by automation, by computer learning, AI. And, you know, really, as teachers, we need to be focusing on problem-solving, metacognition, critical thinking, collaboration, communication.
Yeah.
The question is, how do we do that?
And also, I know, being at your school today, that technology plays a huge part of it, and I think, yeah, we just have to prepare the kids for seeing technology as valuable tools and tools that they have a curiosity against, that they want to explore and want to keep learning, have this lifelong learning approach to technology, instead of seeing it as something that is going to replace that job, just to see, okay, how can I, no matter if I want to be a farmer or a dentist or whatever, but how can I use technology to do this job in a new way? That's important to give them that mindset.
Mm-hmm. I think the key word you used there was the tool. Technology is a tool. It's a tool that we create and a tool that we manipulate and use. And it's having students understand that the technology is at their mercy. They can decide what it does and they can take it further than we already have. So just ensuring that children aren't just consuming that, but are creating.
Yeah, but the concern that I sometimes can have when I see how things develop here in Europe is that we talked about the Manchester area, for example, and then I think in general when I travel here in Britain, I know that England has created a lot of wealth, also being in the forefront of the Industrial Revolution at that time, and the rest of Europe was behind.
Mm-hmm.
But right now I think we see something similar where we in Asia see that they are much more, and in Silicon Valley and so on, the forefront of the fourth Industrial Revolution. And I think in Europe we are sleeping and way behind. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have that fear that, and I think it's just, especially for schools, it's so important to adjust to that, because I think a lot of the challenges or problems that we can see for families, and for example in Manchester, where there's maybe a lot of people now being unemployed, it's because we as school systems don't react fast enough. We haven't made that change. So area that used to be have a lot of jobs and have a lot of manufacturing jobs suddenly don't have those jobs more, but the schools haven't adjusted to it in time. And I have sometimes the concern that we are doing that all over Europe right now, that we are not taking the changes that are happening now serious enough.
Yeah, it's very concerning. And it's great to see schools like Leighton Primary School in Blackpool, you know, who are really making a push with something like coding.
Yeah.
Again, a lot of those children may not grow up to be coders, but they are learning really valuable skills, problem solving, working as a team, critical thinking, that they can go on to apply in another scenario.
Yeah, and I think also it's important, as you say, they're not growing up to be coders, but I think they will all experience how software will again and again transform their life. And I talked with a farmer in Denmark a couple of weeks ago who was growing wine in Denmark. And it's, wine is, of course, Denmark's quite northern part for growing wine, so harvesting at the right time and so on. And he has sensors on every... row of wine, so he can follow the temperatures at night and so on and find the right time. But a lot of his work is actually in front of the computer harvesting the data from it before he harvests the wine and so on. So I think a lot of areas where we thought, okay, software is not that important for it. And he needed that kind of software, and that it didn't exist, so he needed to find developers that could help him solve the needs that he has. And I think we already see that now.
Absolutely. I think one of our earlier podcasts with Rob Herben at Agora International School in the Netherlands, you know, they had a similar thing where they wanted to track skills, and it ended up being three of the students who put together, who coded the online system for tracking skills and tracking learning online. So it just shows that if students are given these opportunities,
That was one of I really enjoyed that episode of your podcast, and have thought I need to visit that school at some day. That is.
Yeah, we should all go there together sometime.
Yeah.
And there we go. Road trip.
Right. <Yeah.
laughs> Open their door. Say, okay, now we are here.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you had a blank canvas for creating a school, I think you would definitely look at Agora as a very good framework for building those 21st century skills.
Yeah.
And for the way in which companies like Google operate, and you know how teamwork actually works in the real world.
And also their physical learning environment is so inspiring too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One thing I did notice there, and before I traveled to Finland and visited a few schools there, and one of the things that really stuck out to me though was how much they connected to their communities and how supportive their communities were. So there were parents who were coming in, supporting these students for 2 to 3 week projects.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if the rest of Europe, I'm not sure if you'd agree, in Denmark is quite ready for that yet. And whether there is that importance actually put onto education for communities to support schools.
Yeah, I think my vision for this as well, that to break those barriers between the local communities and schools, that we don't see that as some kind of silo or a place where we just where our kids are while we work and then they are put away there. But I actually think also working on a school board where my kids go to school, and when I see all the resources and the knowledge and the different workplaces that the parents are working. And see, there's so much, so many resources in bringing those parents in from time to time and let them speak about the work that they are doing or the things that they have access to. And so I think if you could create some learning spaces that were much more open and had the, maybe also maybe could have time where it was optional if you will come, but where a little bit like a library where you could come as a family and make a project together, or if you could create something that was much more a learning environment for lifelong learning, where we as communities could come together and create projects.
Mm.
I think that would be one of my visions for learning that.
I think sort of going back full circle, and one of the problems in the UK is this over-focus and over-emphasis on assessment. So assessment of the children, so that value on a grade score, but also assessment of the school. And so in the UK, we have Ofsted, which is the education board, if you like, which is monitoring schools, ensuring standards are being met. But that process of schools being inspected every 3 to 5 years, it really inhibits innovation. And you do get, you know, occasional cases where, you know, schools like the Olive Tree, Leighton, who are doing amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
But all the time, schools are so restricted by what they can do and what they will do, because they're so fearful of getting a bad grade on these Ofsted inspections, because that really defines what the school is.
Yeah.
You know, the conversations that I've had with other parents the same age as my son, and they were saying, well, oh, we're not going to send him to that school because they didn't get an outstanding rating in Ofsted. They're only good.
Mm.
And that Ofsted rating often ends up defining what the school is. And why would a school take a risk like that, like getting the community involved, when, well, you know, that could affect the grades, so we're not going to go near that.
I think that's really, really interesting, because when we look at how you brought up companies like Google and then the tech industry in general, Apple, and how they, and also especially maybe small entrepreneurs in that field, they need to take risks. And I think when we look at innovation is about risk taking,
mm-hmm.
and then also failing is a part of progress.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying, okay, we have a system that is so that where taking a risk and maybe fail is really looked down on. That can kill innovation and education.
Definitely.
And it is high stakes when it comes to education. Yeah. If you have, as Chris was mentioning, if you have a bad Ofsted report, then that has huge effects on the community as a whole, as well as everyone who works there, attends there. And then if it is a primary school, for the middle schools, high schools, looking at the students coming from those schools, there's already some form of bias over those students because they've gone to a good school rather than an outstanding school.
But I think there must also be so much uncertainty to that because, of course, they base it on some kind of data as well, but also the visits, it must be so small glimpse into the reality that they get. It must be really hard to measure, and especially if we talked about skills like collaboration and so on. And that's so hard to measure, and it didn't get measured at all.
Yeah.
So maybe if you have a system that measures the wrong data points.
And well, we belong to a schools group which has got 70 schools around the world, and a lot of the really innovative schools you see are in Asia, Vietnam, Singapore, Hong Kong, and they aren't tied to these inspection models that we have here in the UK. And if you look at what they're doing in terms of assessment, in terms of student agency, collaboration, it's totally different than what most UK schools could get away with.
I've always found it really interesting in the UK that they give you notice for when they're coming in. So my very first job in a lower economic area of London, we knew that Ofsted would be coming, so they told us to plan lessons. You've got 2 weeks to plan some fantastic lessons for when they come in, which is bizarre. I mean, we were already trying to plan the best lessons we could. But, you know, I think that personally an inspection body should come in whenever. Yeah. They shouldn't have to give any notice. But I think they should have lower expectations. They shouldn't come in and see the whizzes and bangs. They need to come in and just see how a school operates and how do students interact with each other and their environment.
Yeah, and I think today we are at Apple Distinguished School, and I think we often, one of the criteria for becoming that is that we have a strategy for working with innovation, an innovative approach to leadership, to the facilities and so on. And I think criteria like that, and to see, do we have a system in place for how we let our staff try out ideas, how we experiment, how we evaluate those, how we adjust to that feedback and so on. I think that would allow much more innovation. I think in a system where a government wants to have some kind of quality assurance, but if they were much, much more looking into how does the leadership actually have a strategy for innovating, how do they... every school will, from time to time, have their challenges, but how do they actually adjust to those challenges? What kind of strategies do they have in place for that? I think that would be a much more interesting system to look at.
Yeah, and that Apple Distinguished School approach to how you actually evidence the learning and the innovation that you're having as a school is certainly not going to be adapted by many governments around the world, but it's a really interesting way of reflecting as a school community, you know, where are you in your journey of innovation? What's going to be the next steps? How are you involving all of the parts of the community?
A question for you guys then would be, how do Apple support and mentor schools who want to become Apple Distinguished School? Do they support, mentor, continue that journey with you?
The Apple Distinguished School program is by invitation only, so it's not something that necessarily any school could become a part of. You have to be invited within that. Okay. But there is definitely an aspect of that which is mentoring and giving you advice and next steps. And then once you're part of that community, it's also supporting each other and also learning from each other within that ADS network. I know in the UK, I think there's around 30 ADS schools now.
And I think there's a quite good books that provided by Apple on the Apple bookstore about the elements of innovation, leadership, but also ideas for lesson plans. There are a lot of good guidance. I can't remember all the titles right now, but
yeah.
I think we can include some of them in the show notes. So I think there are some tools and some inspiration for everyone working with school leadership can get find some inspiration. And you said also that Apple Distinguished Schools work together. I think that's maybe sometimes the real challenge to how do we keep innovating when we first are Apple Distinguished School. And I think a lot of the learning is not necessarily provided by Apple, but I think the really valuable things are actually when schools connect and learn from each other. And there's some of those innovation summits that Apple hosts, but what I think the connection that gives between schools are those that are really, really valuable.
Yeah, I think that's key when it comes to assessment of then what happens afterwards. How do you help each other improve and how do you stop people kind of resting on their laurels? Okay, we're now an Apple Distinguished School. We just stop.
Yeah.
We need to continue to support people to innovate and grow continually because it never ends.
Or the same if it was an Ofsted inspection. We're now an outstanding school. So what? Where are we going to go for the next 5 years?
Yeah. I saw a bit of a similar challenge with my previous school and in general, and I think I tried to work a lot with that it is really hard to, I think after those five, seven years, I think a lot of schools maybe lose a bit of momentum. The people that had taken the long hours developing the strategies, following up on it, maybe also get a bit tired, and maybe it's a bit of like in a relationship that most know that when you are in a relationship for 7 years, there's a bit of a crisis before. Then the children grow up and you find each other again. But I think it's a bit similar, I see in the school world, that it's actually hard to keep that momentum after 5-7 years of innovating.
I've only been married for 6 years, so I wouldn't know.
Oh, the next year, 2020.
Look out for next year.
Yeah,
I think it also comes down to how staff are retained, how they're trained. And we were talking on our conversations around the school today about our model to professional development and developing these professional learning communities and getting the staff buy-in and having that agency from the staff to delve into topics that they're really interested in also helps keep that momentum going and keep that innovation going. You know, if it's coming from the ground up, very often there can be a bit more buy-in there from staff. Whereas if it's coming from the top down, you know, from the principal, then it's always going to be a bit more of a challenge.
Yeah. I think we have covered a lot of topics today and got off our coffee. So I would like to hear, I think if we look at ourselves, we will have quite a number of years in education until we can retire, if we want to retire. So if we look ahead in the future, 20, 30 years, or what do you think would be some of the craziest things that we can expect to see before we retire?
Interesting question. And I think, you know, technology is going to have a big role in that, definitely. And if you look at some of the biggest changes in the past 10 years, it's sort of revolved around technology. I think there's a lot of scope for artificial intelligence and bringing that within teaching and learning. I'm really interested to see how things like augmented reality shape out. And there's a lot of talk of, you know, using goggles, whether it's virtual reality. I think that could be interesting so long as it's moving beyond that gimmicky stage. I would love to see what a classroom would look like with 30 children sat around with 30 different headsets on.
What I sometimes think about, one thing is those technologies evolving. What I really hope where we see changes maybe in the mindset about education.
Definitely.
And I think that's, will we still have classrooms where every kid is the same age? And will we see a development there? Will we see some new idea approaches to?
That's one that I think will eventually happen. Visiting in the Netherlands, I went to a Jenneplan school. So they have 2 year groups together. And you can see that collaboration across the year groups. And although I don't think it's particularly useful to have a child in kindergarten with a child in grade five too often. There is definitely scope for students to work with people across ages. Just because of when you're born doesn't mean it's developmentally appropriate to work with certain people at certain times. So I do think that year groups is one of the things that could change.
And also this, in Denmark, we divide everything up to subject, and I think we also do it here, but you as teachers, you cover a lot more subjects than most teachers do in Denmark. So I think also that gives maybe an opportunity for much more cross-curricular approach to education or teaching.
I mean, as our school, we're a transdisciplinary school. So we have language classes, math classes, and units, which should encompass kind of everything else. I think we could see more of an approach towards that. One of the big interest areas for me will be data in schools. I think we've seen a real big drive towards data, and I don't know whether that will eventually let up or whether that's going to continue and be the driver for education in the next 20, 30 years.
I think data is a really, really interesting, and it could be a whole new episode.
Yeah,
data is definitely interesting, and I think it's so important that I think it can be good to use data, but we should be very aware of what we are measuring and why we are measuring
it,
and how and what we want to use it for. But I sometimes think about, will we come into a time where we will start teaching? I sometimes think that my kids will maybe be one of the last generations of kids that will not be some kind of genetically modified kids. Will we start to see CRISPR getting used there? Or we have seen it a bit with, I can't remember his name, the runner from South Africa that is now in jail. But Blade Runner.
Oscar Pistorius.
Oscar Pistorius. But in general, that we saw that it used to be that prostheses were something that where we get abilities that were a bit less than the human body used to have. And then he got some blades that were actually allowing him to maybe to run faster, or at least now the technology is so advanced that people that have those blades actually can't compete with normal people because they actually have an advantage. We maybe will see the same with hearing and sight and so on, that we... So if our employer suddenly, or the military could say, I actually want those that maybe they were born blind, but now they have got some artificial sight, and we have used to say, why shouldn't they only see the colors that we do? Maybe they could also see infrared and so on. And we see, I don't know if it was actually just a rumor of it was right, but I think there were scientists in China that had said that he had used CRISPR technology for a child, but we see CRISPR where they edit the genome for plants and experiments with animals and so on. So I expect that we will see that with children in the next 20, 30 years.
A bionic student.
Yeah. Scary, interesting. I'm not sure which way that goes.
But that's sometimes I think, will I experience that before I retire to start having children in my classroom that will be genetically modified and some not, and how would that actually put those kids that are not genetically modified if they are in a workforce? So that's sometimes when I get too much coffee.
I think we're going back to that start of the start of the podcast where we were talking about having a conversation about the purpose of education. And maybe this is the right time to just everyone to be sitting down and saying, what is the purpose of education? Do we want those kind of things in education, and how will that look? Because we are at a crossroads. We are very, very quickly hurtling into a very different kind of world than we've had for the last 100 years. And it's about time we all sat down and had a chat.
Yeah. Should we say, grab a cup of coffee more, but maybe without the listeners? And
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Yeah. Definitely, yeah. My coffee has disappeared.
Yeah. But thank you for opening your door today. And.
Well, thank you for joining us for coffee.
I'm so happy that I could join your podcast today. that we could make something together. That was fantastic.
It's been great.
Well, I have to say that was a lot of fun. It was really great to have the chance to try a different style, and it was so awesome to work with Jacob and create this collaboration episode with his podcast, Breakfast Conversations. It was awesome that he's taken the time out of his busy schedule to travel with his son and explore London, visit schools as they go. And we really, really appreciate popping in to visit us and to record the show. So be sure to check out Breakfast Conversations and make sure that you get in touch with us here at Open Door 2. So you can find Jacob on Twitter at Jacob Esben. So that's at Jacob, J-A-K-O-B, Esben, E-S-B-E-N, all one word. And talk about the show using his hashtag, hashtag Breakfast Conversations. Be sure to also use our hashtag, hashtag Open Door Pod. Chat to Chris and I directly on Twitter at Mr. Blowers and at cgallyedu. Or leave us a voice message on Anchor. We'd love to hear your ideas of who or what you would love to hear on the show. Or if you have something to share, drop us a line and we look forward to chatting with you in the future. Thanks a lot for listening.